Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, the GOP released their budget proposals, and it's good news if you like massive cuts in discretionary spending and a bloated defense budget. We'll detail the broad strokes of a funding fantasia that probably won't pass and will likely lead to some new apocalyptic showdown. Meanwhile, Illinois Congressman Aaron Schock is resigning his seat after the public disclosure of his Downton Abbey-themed office inspired reporters to investigate the numerous ways Schock was spending taxpayer money. But is this the best we can do when it comes to fighting government corruption? Sadly, yes. Finally, Starbucks has decided to take on race relations in America by asking their baristas to lead a national conversation about it. Are the baristas getting paid more? Will the coffee taste better? What exactly is a caramel flan latte? We have three white dudes on hand to talk about this, so sit back and listen to us make a sad, blundering hash of unformed thoughts and unintended microaggressions out of this topic. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Arthur Delaney. We'll have all of this and more for you today, but here's what happened first. Ooh, that was rough. Me reading words. Good morning or afternoon. I don't know. I always start with like some kind of like time. Good people of America. Welcome to So That Happened, the globally famous show about events that have occurred in the past.
Greetings. We're happy to see you.
I'm Jason Linkins and I'm joined by
Arthur Delaney.
Right. Senior politics reporter from the Huffington Post and also
Zach Carter.
Senior economic reporter from the Huffington Post. You guys have great like job titles.
Well, you can get a title upgrade in lieu of a raise, so I opted for that.
Me too.
Not.
There was a time when you worked for Huffington Post where you wanted to have something like staff reporter in your name because people would always think that you were an unpaid blogger. That distinction was very important for your career, whether you
staff.
Were paid or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to do that. Now I don't care about that.
Now
all I care about is titles.
Titles are great. I love my title.
Titles,
love it.
That's good. That's good. My title is,
Fart Sauce.
Fart Sauce, exactly.
Hi, I'm Jason Linkins, Fart Sauce for the Huffington Post.
Welcome to the Fart Sauce Hour. So how's everybody's week going?
Oh, man, it's been awesome. The politics news has been popping.
It has been popping and locking.
So many different things. There's silliness, there's policy. It's a poo-poo platter of politics.
All right, well, you just want to get down to it, man. You don't even want to exchange pleasantries with us anymore.
Yeah, why don't you talk about your dog or something? God.
He had a tummy ache this morning.
My dog threw up on my bed on Wednesday. It was the worst. I got a note saying, from our dog walker, being like, yeah, your dog threw up on your bed. And you just know that is going to be terrible.
My kid was throwing up last night, and my dog ate it, so I think that's why he didn't feel good this morning.
You had to admire his contribution to cleaning up your kid's puke, though.
We do admire it. We always thank him, but I thought, well, if the kid has a bug, this could have repercussions, and it may have happened.
I like to think that your kid and your dog are going to have, like, adventures.
Yeah, they're having adventures in gastroenteritis or whatever.
Eating each other's puke.
Okay. Well, there's the transition we needed, Arthur. Thank you, because now we're going to talk about the budget, the Republican budget.
Yeah.
Which is like gastroenteritis.
It's like a pile of puke.
Right. You need a suppository to fix that shit. Saline drip.
It actually,
get your game tight again.
They came out with, as conservative a budget as seemed possible for them to just conceive out of thin air, which is how they did it. It's not designed to actually become law or, be approved by the Senate. by the president. And they had a hiccup. The House Budget Committee couldn't even get it out on time.
Why couldn't they get it out on time?
Because they're having a it turns out that it's the laundry day. The extra money they put in there to appease defense hawks wasn't doing its appeasement job. And
it wasn't the Neville Chamberlain of budget line items.
Right. Like, people just aren't happy. And so they're fighting over whether, you know, how much extra money they're going to throw at the military lost in this.
How are they
going to
raise the extra money?
They get the extra money by just going to town on any social safety net spending. A lot of people were making fun of it because it calls for the House and Senate budgets both call for enormous cuts to programs like Medicaid, food stamps, housing assistance, just everything.
Literally, there's a line for discretionary spending, which is like all of the stuff that the government does that isn't basically health insurance or bombing stuff.
Yeah.
And that is cut by
$1 trillion.
Yeah, I thought it was half a trillion, but
full T. And there's no specificity. I mean, in a budget committee's budget document, there typically isn't much specificity, but people were really remarking on it this week because of the magnitude of these cuts. So you're going to call for $1 trillion, and it's for this category of spending that includes many programs such as food stamps, and they just didn't say exactly what would happen.
It's kind of like the sequester, right? Where the sequester is just like, you got to cut 15%.
The military suddenly become skint or something? Because the last time I checked, they have a budget bigger than, I think, every other military on the planet.
There's a proportion to an understanding of military spending in relation to what the rest of the world spends on it that is just absolutely not
staggering.
Part of this conversation.
Right.
Yeah, it is staggering. Like, we're number one. It's awesome. But what's fresh in people's minds is the sequester. Remember the sequester?
Yeah, I remember that.
Where we deliberately cut everything, including the military, by about 5%.
Right. For those of people who don't remember the sequester, and I feel like that's impossible, the sequester, or sequestration, to be grammatically correct, like grammatically correct douchebags.
Sequester is a number.
Yeah, sequester is a verb. Sequestration is a noun. Okay, we got that.
We can just call it the number clusterfuck from 2013.
The sequestration came about as a part of the Budget Control Act, which impaneled a group of people called the Super Committee to make to sort of craft that fabled grand bargain about entitlement spending and tax reform, blah, 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 blah,
They
blah.
Didn't do it.
And they were like, okay, so the stick – there's no carrots in this. The carrot is you get to call yourself a super committee. The stick is if you fail as a super committee, we cut the budget radically. And the way we've designed these budget cuts to be is like we imagine like what if a bunch of serial killers and people who hated America went at our budget. And it was supposed to be so crazy and threatening, the super committee couldn't help but do something about it. Of course they failed. And of course we got stuck with, you know, the Robert Durst of budgets.
So the sequester happened. It hurt all kinds of spending, discretionary spending. It didn't hurt mandatory spending, which is things like Social Security.
But it did cut from the military budget.
It substantially
made John McCain sad.
Now, there was a Patty Murray, Paul Ryan budget that lifted some of the sequester, but we're still in a sequester world, and that's what the defense hawks are reacting
sequester
to.
Sequester world, and it's where you wait in line and all the rides crash.
It is interesting that the defense hawks have consolidated so much power within the House GOP, because I think when we're watching—
Gotta bomb somebody.
Well, but you know, when we were watching the Tea Party races in the 2014 primaries, you know, the big question, the sort of talk of the town was, okay, well, will these, you know, small government Tea Party guys be able to fend off the sort of big business Republican establishment guys?
Nope.
Right. But they couldn't. But it turns out that those big business Republican establishment guys are also big military, spend a lot on the military guys. And we haven't seen a whole lot of economic policy stuff coming out of the House since November of 2014. But we have seen all of this stuff, at least symbolic stuff, on the military. And when you think about the stuff going on with ISIS and the authorization for the use of military force, the hawks have really it's very interesting that the hawks have got so much power. When just a few years ago, you know, Republicans were voting down Obama efforts to bomb Syria. They were criticizing the Obama invasion of Libya.
So with $1 trillion cut from non-military
discretionary spending.
I mean, and that excludes the things they do to Medicare, Medicaid,
sure.
Social Security, which also get whacked, except for Social Security. They say, it's confusing to me. They say, we're going to voucherize Medicare, which is the Paul Ryan plan to what Democrats said, we'll end Medicare.
Everybody gets a coupon for health care. It's not pegged to inflation. It's not pegged to wages.
They're going
to... As time goes on, it gets less and less valuable until it's, you know, like a
cracker.
Right. They would also put a lid on Medicaid spending, put a lid on food stamp spending, but they came to Social Security and said, you know what? Someone's got to figure this out. This is literally what it says in the budget summary. It says someone will have to figure this out. In the text of the actual legislation, somebody has to figure this out. Perhaps a bipartisan commission. It doesn't even say definitely we need a bipartisan commission. It says one solution
could
be.
Do you realize that, like, if you boarded a plane today and be like, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be flying to San Diego today. Weather is, you know, nice, wind velocity regular, and today the plane will be piloted by a bipartisan commission. You get the fuck off that plane.
Because they have a stunning record. So we had the bipartisan commission, the super committee. That didn't work.
Right.
We had the deficit commission that President Obama put together.
Right. Way back when we had
it. Which did deal with Social Security. Simpson-Bowles had at least recommendations for Social Security, and it was a complete failure.
And yet people look to this like a real icon of bipartisan accomplishment.
Yeah.
But Jason Lincoln's, you've pointed out many times.
I think they go back to the old BRAC commissions.
Their commissions have worked in the past.
Well, yeah. I mean, when it's something like that, and you've got to like be able to like shut down bases without disrupting multi-state economies, people have a vested interest.
In the early 1980s.
No one has a vested interest.
Commissions have worked for Social Security. They did reform and improve the solvency of Social Security in the early 1980s with a Greenspan commission. So there's a historical reason, but it just way predates all these fiascos we've had since. So that's what they're taking a really long view. But it's just weird that they have to punt when they're willing to go at Medicare. I don't fully understand the politics of that. But anyway.
Well, I think the reason they're punting on Social Security, even though they're willing to go at Medicare, is that they've figured they already have to deal with the fallout from the Ryan budget from a few years ago. That sort of horse has left the barn.
Oh, they're knee deep in Medicare. So like, we'll just stay here.
Yeah.
We're just in this mess already. Let's just keep trucking.
With $1 trillion cut from non-military spending, I have to ask, does the Republican Party fancy ever wanting to like create a domestic policy program of any kind?
No, it's
because they no longer have the money to do
anything. This $1 trillion figure we're only using to refer to a specific slice of non-military spending. The overall figure is $5 trillion.
And it's a joke. I mean, the accounting on this is a total joke.
Well, it's what's so strange about this is that it's the budget committee document is supposed to be broad and theoretical, and then Congress approves a budget, and then it is the job of committees of jurisdiction to figure out how they will achieve the savings the broader outline has called for. But it's theoretical to begin with, but we are in yet another theoretical level where it does not appear they have any plan to eventually go through regular order with committees of jurisdiction to approve a budget that the president would sign.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's two orders of theoretical away from ever happening. I think Andrew Taylor with the Associated Press does the best job in his every story on this subject of reminding the reader how far we are from any of these cuts actually taking effect, which is difficult to do.
But even if they did take effect, the accounting on them is ridiculous. They count, you know, billions of dollars in savings from eliminating the subsidies under Obamacare.
Right.
Republicans have said, you know, they haven't shown us an actual plan, but they've said for years, well, we want to repeal and replace Obamacare. Well, presumably you're going to replace it with something that actually costs money. And there's no figure for what their, you know, mythical as yet sort of developed plan to replace it with will cost. It's like three orders of abstraction away from reality when you actually think about the fact that they're going to have to actually govern if this type of thing were ever implemented.
So we're so far in Plato's cave that it's not even the shadow on the wall. We're looking at a reflection of the shadow on a different wall. We're like two chambers deep. But anyway, so they say they eventually get something. That it's possible because we will need a government funding this fall.
Cromnibus returns.
Something, you know, it could be another can kicking. Or
Cromnibus 2.
Yeah, we're going to need a Cromnibus, or we're going to have a government shutdown. And some people, for instance, Ben White at Politico, say the way this is going portends very badly for the debt ceiling, which is going to happen around the same time as the government shutdown.
Got to mint that coin. Got to mint that trillion-dollar coin. All right, so we'll move on to a different cave, a more ostentatiously decorated cave, Downton Abbey themed cave. This week, our good friend,
friend of the show,
He's not a friend of the show. He's never been on the show, which is why we're gonna rip him a new asshole. No, Aaron Schock.
Oh,
Aaron Schock, dude, the flip cups of Instagram representative from Illinois, resigned.
I was, I'm going to love this. I was shocked.
Oh, my God.
I was shocked.
You are fired.
Oh, God. Yes.
You are demoted to junior reporter.
I was actually.
I want Zach's mic cut for the next 30 seconds. Punishment.
I was actually stunned. I was actually stunned. I did not think he was going to resign.
You know, there was a story that said the decorator who actually did the office. So, like, this was not a Downton Abbey office. The congressman has great taste.
All right, so for those of you who maybe didn't catch this story the last time, Aaron Schock, representative of Illinois, he had a Washington Post reporter named Ben Terrace in his office. Ben Terrace noticed that Aaron Schock's office was painted in a lot more and decorated in a lot more ostentatious, fancy fashion than most Capitol Hill offices. Which, if you've ever been to Capitol Hill, it is like a wall-to-wall sea of concrete and khaki. And so Aaron Schock's office had like these like blood red walls and sprays of pheasant feathers and all these kind of like very, very peculiar decorations. And the interior designer happened to be there and was like, oh, I'll show you around. And so Ben Terrace snapped all these photographs and the interior designer said, oh, well, you know, it's themed, you know, it's inspired by Downton Abbey. And what happened was Aaron Schock's communications director found out that Ben Terrace had this conversation with his interior designer, snapped all his pictures, and then very stupidly tried to get him to not report the story, which is the first thing you don't ever do if you don't want a story reported, is to try to stop it from being reported.
And what is the technical term for this phenomenon?
The Streisand effect.
Yeah.
The Streisand effect.
Because Barbara Streisand once tried to suppress photos of her like coastal estate.
Yes.
Only making it...
A photographer studying coastal erosion in California snapped all these pictures of beachfront property, including hers. It was just for research. No one in the world cared about the photo until Barbara Streisand tried to get it taken down.
Yeah.
And then suddenly everybody was looking at Barbara Streisand's house. Okay, so people got interested in how Aaron Schock was spending his time and spending his money.
Well, and it was amazing because I thought this was going to end with just a terrific story from Ben Terrace, which was hilarious. He could have done like a nothing story about this guy's office, which no one would have cared about. But the fact that the guy was protesting so heavily throughout the piece about trying to, you know, Terrace had it in his story, the comms director was trying to crush the story, made it really, really interesting. And so then everybody was like, huh. Maybe we should who's paying for this like really ostentatious and conspicuously consume oriented office.
Yeah. So Schock's gone. It looks like the killing blow is dealt by Politico, who uncovered the fact that Schock had claimed I think $170,000 worth of mileage reimbursement for his personal vehicle. It turns out that he had sold the vehicle, and at the time of the sale, the vehicle only had 80,000 miles on it. So unless—
I love that amazingly clever way of finding out the miles were a sham. Wow.
Yep.
Good sleuthing.
How did they get the— I mean, I guess you have to list the mileage when you sell a car.
They got good reporters. They have good reporters.
I'm sure they probably found some way of tracking the VIN number and then tracing the VIN number along its point of sale and then determined that— the claims didn't match the actual reality of the car.
But there, I mean, a lot of hilarious stuff had come. I mean, the guy who originally tried to suppress the photos turned out to be to have what was it? What were his misdeeds?
He had said a lot of really nasty stuff on Facebook about
people. Wait, that's the same guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it was just a cascade of absurdly absurd stories.
Yeah, that guy lived in Washington. This Aaron Schock staffer, communications director, he lived in Washington and was like upset that there were black people in Washington.
Yeah.
which is like being upset there's like snow in Vermont. God damn, it's cold up here. Fuck this cold. Vermont needs to do something about it.
Which, I mean, was basically what Chocolate he said City, on Facebook, and it was like not, it was pretty, they were pretty distasteful comments.
So Jason.
Distasteful. Yeah.
There was there's a sad element to this story that you explored.
Yeah.
In a post this week. Why don't just tell us about what was sad about this.
Okay, what's sad about this is that you know, corruption in our government is rampant. Rampant, rampant, rampant. And what's sick and sad about the way our government works now is that there's been a series of Supreme Court rulings that have sort of substantially underpinned this new campaign finance regime that's like really super corrupt, dark and secret. And our campaign finance reality is that every single person in the legislature is, you know, essentially on the take. Unless they're somehow heroically preventing themselves from being.
Because if they want to keep their jobs, they need tons of money from
In the Supreme Court's mind, government corruption now solely equals a quid pro quo bribe in which there's like a real currency that can be traced to a real decision made by a real legislator in which the person who provided a tangible sum of money
in a paper bag, and it had to be a brown paper bag, kind of crumpled,
ideally stuffed in the freezer, like Representative William Jefferson of Louisiana back in the day. Remember that dude?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And what really our campaign finance system has managed to become is this sort of like very fluid system in which essentially special interest groups, major corporate interests, bribe officials all the time, but it's so dark and invisible and fungible that you can't track.
There's no contract.
Like a dollar for a decision.
Right. There's no contract that says for this $10,000 you will vote against the Affordable Care Act.
Right. Sad about this is that there's a full, we're literally like waist deep in a sea of corruption in Washington.
You had a good example in your story.
There's a few good examples. I mean, just this week, Paul Blumenthal reported on how the payday lending industry funded a lot of campaigns and got a lot of favorable votes from legislators through dark money donations to people's campaign platforms. There's an example. There's a bill called the Frank Lautenberg Chemical Safety Bill. That's making its way through Congress, in which it was revealed that one of the co-chairs of the bill, Udall from New Mexico, shared the bill with one of the polluter lobbies, the American Chemistry Society.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Society or something, and you know, a team of reporters got a hold of the material and found this the lobbyist digital signatures all over it
on the PDF document of the legislation.
Yeah, and so you know, they were able to, they literally were just like, tell us what you think about the bill. And then Udall's office had the gall to say, it was like, well, we reached out to stakeholders to make the best bill possible. And it was like, you don't know, it's not the best bill possible if you've like reached out to the people you're trying to regulate and be like, tell us how we cannot hurt you.
Yeah, and the thing is, the people who are putting their digital fingerprints on the bill are the people who lawmakers have lunch with.
Yeah.
And these are ostensibly like clean and okay meetings where
people
you pay a campaign and you have lunch with a congressman and nothing quid pro quo happens.
People don't understand that like the bulk of what a congressman does in his daily life is he calls people and asks for money.
Yeah.
And so there's so little time to actually like have original thoughts about policy that, you know, sometimes the same people that they're calling on the phone are like, well, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll write that law for you.
Yeah, or talk to my friend Chris. He'll write it up.
Yeah, he'll write it up. And so you know, I think a lot of people have this conception that on Capitol Hill we have like legislators who come here and do a lot of original thinking and a lot of like crunching data and reality and talking to people and developing these kind of like original ideas about policies. No, that is not what Congress is. Congress is by and large a few hundred empty vessels into which major corporate interests and lobbyists fill ideas that they then parrot back and make into law.
Now, stakeholders are supposed – have input on legislation, but it's, you know, there's a hearing process where –
the country is not being run and laws are not being created by the pure products of a legislator's imagination.
Yeah. But Aaron Schock had a funny –
Yeah, but the thing is that – so we caught Aaron Schock. This is what's sad. We caught Aaron Schock. For some penny ante bullshit.
He didn't do the miles right. Yeah.
Miles shit. Yeah, I mean, I think taxpayers have a right to be aggrieved. I'm not saying we let them off the fucking hook. But, like, what we don't do is we don't have this fucking hallelujah chorus where we're like, yeah, we got one. We got him.
What you're basically saying.
I don't think we have that.
We don't nail shit.
I don't think people are spiking the football on Aaron.
You know, you should have been there on Twitter that day. But
people were just making, myself included, we were just making Downton Abbey jokes.
Maybe so. But, like, you know, it's a really slight accomplishment.
It's
like
you're really saying Arthur's going to love this one. You're basically saying that Aaron Schock fouled out on a hand check when everybody else has been throwing elbows the whole game.
Yeah, exactly. Traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like fouling out on traveling.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the refs in the UVA Maryland game.
Actually, that's pretty good. Traveling. It was.
Right.
He did foul out.
It was traveling. Yeah. So we got Aaron Schock, but like you got to understand that like you know, there are so many heads that need to go on so many pikes in this town that, like...
Wow, that is a violent metaphor.
The one doesn't satisfy me. The one doesn't satisfy me.
The sports metaphor.
Ah, I want...
Flagrant.
We
technical.
All know... I want... You know, I like to see a little more blood in the street, to be perfectly honest. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. This is really silly. Okay, so a lot of us here in this office are familiar with the work of Liz Mayer. She's a Republican consultant, a communications consultant.
Very nice woman.
Super nice woman. And
busy on Twitter.
One of the best interviews in the world because she's like unfiltered, honest. Like me, she's wired for cynicism. She's great. So she was briefly hired by Scott Walker's campaign. I don't want to inflate her title because she was like, don't inflate my title. But she was essentially hired to do contract work in digital social media for Scott Walker.
She was the international president of all things Scott Walker.
Right. That's a bit of an job inflation.
Sorry.
All right.
I'm a senior political economy reporter.
So what ended up happening were two things. One is she tweeted some frankly honest things about the Iowa GOP and what a bunch of gang of fuck-ups they were.
And how they dragged the party rightward by virtue of their first-in-the-nation primary caucus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The most coddled goddamn state in the union.
So because it's the first contest in a primary, all the Republicans pander to Iowa as part of the candidate. It's just like not a representative state at all.
Everyone panders to Iowa except for Liz Mayer and me. We're like, Iowa, you're not that great. Sorry. You're okay.
It's kind of nice in Iowa.
Whatever.
It's really kind of pretty.
Whatever. Corn. Whatever. So, okay.
Omaha's right across the river. I mean.
So Democratic oppo people fed like some of these like kind of like frank tweets about the Iowa GOP to the Des Moines Register. Simultaneously, those freak jobs at Breitbart started attacking Liz Mayer for her non-orthodox views on any number of issues. Liz is not a nativist crank on immigration. She's pro-gay marriage. I believe she is in some ways more pro-abortion or pro-choice than other Republicans. So
she shows human compassion on it.
Right.
Breitbart is a real weird website.
And they really tore after her. They even put up an article insinuating there's something dark about the fact that she's a dual citizen with the United States and the UK. And she was asked by this reporter, Matt Boyle, my friend Megan Carpentier refers to as Derek. So I'm going to insist that for the rest of the podcast, if we're going to talk about Matt Boyle, we call him Derek.
Wait, why?
It's a long story, and it's better told by Megan Carpentier. So email Megan Carpentier and be like, why do you call Matt Boyle Derek? It's a great story.
Okay, listeners, do that.
Okay, so Derek wrote a thing that he literally asked her, is American citizenship not good enough? And it was like, she is an American citizen. Like, it is to the extent that American citizenship is good, she's an American citizen.
You know who else had dual citizenship?
Samantha Lachman, HuffPost reporter Sam Lachman.
I was going to say citizen. Winston Churchill.
Oh, I didn't know that about Winston Churchill.
We made him an honorary citizen.
Well, there you go.
Also a giant fuck-up in World War I.
Yeah, well, really, he made up for that, Zach, didn't he?
He really pulled a fucking rabbit out of the hat with World War II. It is amazing.
He did, man.
His blunders in the Dardanelles Strait. Really stayed with you.
Yeah. A lot of people died in Gallipoli. A lot.
Well, anyway, I think saving the free world more than makes up for
it. So what's crazy is that Liz...
I'm tempted to agree.
What's crazy is that Liz was now been forced out by Scott Walker. Scott Walker accepted her resignation. It's just crazy, right?
So people...
Wait, Breitbart actually succeeded in forcing Liz Mayer out because...
No. The Iowa Republican Party demanded her resignation, and it wasn't because of the Breitbart stuff. Though
that's
the
Iowa
fire.
Stuff.
It was because of the mean tweets about Iowa. And so a lot of people ran with that and said it was the third in a string of examples of Scott Walker pandering to Iowa. The most notable prior one was he switched his position on ethanol subsidies, which are a conservative boogeyman. Because we, they inflate the price of gasoline, and it's green tech oriented, and they don't help, and they are so politically powerful because they disproportionately benefit farmers in Iowa. So people like Tim Carney were saying, Scott Walker, sure, he can stand up to unions and people who are already his political enemy, but when it comes to special interests and people on quote, our side, he's just going to roll over and do what they say.
Yeah.
So he was getting beat up hard over this Liz Mayer thing. I think people said this proves that Scott Walker's a wimp.
It's because outside of the Breitbart community, Liz Mayer actually has a lot of respect in the Republican.
Yeah, it does partly reflect her popularity, but I
think people respect her in general.
It fit a story that had been developing about Scott Walker that actually I think will be damaging to him potentially. Although, I mean, if Iowa's happy, I guess I should take that back.
Can we also just say what a bunch of thin-skinned wimps the Iowa Republican Party are?
Oh, easily.
The most pandered-to state in America. As if this whole country is a bunch of fairs where they make things out of butter. No. Most people live in cities. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Iowa.
Even most Iowans live in cities.
It is just not a...
They hold the process hostage with their first-of-the-nation caucus. And I mean, like, most hostage takers, they at least have the temerity to not whine at you when you're like, hey, I don't like being held hostage. Oh, yeah, well, I'm just trying my best, okay? What, you don't like the restraints they put you in? You know, fuck you. I work hard. I work hard at taking hostages. I'm a hardworking hostage taker. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve this. That's Iowa. Crybaby fucks.
Iowa GOP, anyway. The people I've talked to in Iowa have always been really, really great. I've never encountered a mean
right,
person.
Right, we're talking about the...
Oh, there you go. There you go with your Iowa pandering.
Yeah, I always had a really good time when I was in Iowa, but I never go for political campaigns, you know what, which would probably be insufferable. And
here's the thing. I don't hate Iowans, but like a little cutting against the pandering is a good thing. Like a little, hey, you're not that fucking special. That's good.
You know, people.
That's good. People remind me of that, and it makes me stronger.
People,
you know,
dump on Virginia all the time because there are all sorts of things about Virginia that are not great. You know, being
Virginia's
like
that
international head of the slave trade for a long time. You know, there's some rough suburbs. It's tough. But when they say that, I don't say, you know what? You need to lose your job. You need to be fired. I say, fuck you, man. Virginia rules.
It doesn't, but whatever.
Oh, I was born on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Oh!
Tough guy Arthur from a real urban environment. Yeah.
Anyway,
too
really,
big for the suburb.
Ad hominem is a rhetorical fallacy.
What a crazy thing to
it
happen.
It is. Not fair.
Really crazy thing to happen. Liz Mayer, like me, big Arsenal fan, so... You know, I wish her the best.
There you go with your violent metaphors again. You love Arsenals.
It's a soccer team.
Yeah, well, the teams that I like are called the Cavaliers.
You should not sock women.
We just
the Cavaliers, named after the Tories.
What are you talking? No, it's just they have sort of a flippant attitude about things.
Okay, sure, okay.
They're kind of smug.
One last thing. Very smug. One last thing I want to talk about is how Howard Schultz of Starbucks like cured racism this week. Did you guys hear about this?
This was so weird.
So amazing. We're like, racism's over thanks to coffee.
Well, what? Just explain.
All right, so
coffee's,
you know,
brown, I guess.
So Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, which is a coffee concern you may have heard of. Really revolutionized coffee business in a lot of innovative ways. And what's interesting about Starbucks is that, you know, for the dominance of their chain has nevertheless so altered over the course of decades the sort of like taste for coffee among most Americans that it's actually allowed a lot of smaller coffee businesses to flourish in its wake as well. So it's an interesting business.
Pay the workers pretty well, team.
Yeah. My sister's work at Starbucks. Treated decently.
That's a point of contention, I think, labor.
Okay, yeah, we won't.
Have pilloried Starbucks a little bit, haven't they?
I don't know. Everybody I knew who worked for them, like, kind of was always like, yeah, it's pretty.
All right.
We'll probably hear a lot of stories now because we brought it up. But, okay. But Schultz is not just good enough to be, like, I guess, a coffee guy. Schultz feels the need to be a thought leader as well. And previous experiments of Howard Schultz thought leading was the come together thing, where he was just like, you know what, we'll solve the government shutdown by writing come together on coffee cups. And there's never been a government shutdown or even a moment of contention in Congress since. This time around, he was like, let's do something called race together, where we're going to put a sticker on your coffee cup that says race together. And then he was like, and feel free to have a conversation about racial issues in America with your barista, which is like the fuck you say?
He's like, trying, man. He's trying.
But it's like literally like it's not just good enough to like just come and get my coffee. Like the baristas have to be responsible for maintaining a high level dialogue on race issues in the United States, too. Like,
I mean,
who the fuck
like,
signed up for that?
It does seem like you're asking for there to be a lot of really, really tense conversations in the Starbucks, but in your business. But come on, he's trying. We do have problems with race relations, and I think they would get better if we talked about them more instead of just like, you know, had like Fox and MSNBC.
But at Starbucks with the barista, like you make the barista.
He runs Starbucks. What is he supposed to? He can't change the dialogue on cable TV. He runs Starbucks. That's where he can hear it.
Latte, have you atoned for 3 centuries of slavery and racial discrimination encoded in the law?
Right.
No, but I'm in favor of reparations, which would take away my mind.
Thank you for my coffee. Like, I'm sorry.
So a bunch of reporters actually went around a bunch of Starbucks to see if anyone would talk about race with them. the finest by far was the article written by B. Jolie Shaw for the Frisky, in which she went to 5 Starbucks in New York City and was not a coffee drinker. And she ordered like 5 coffee drinks and attempted to like have conversations about race with the baristas. And like in one example, they ran into some coffee roaster who was on the premises, who was able to parrot sort of like the corporate, like kind of like bland, like here's what it's all about.
So some baristas really met this challenge.
The one guy did with the flashcards he was given by corporate. And everybody else was like, I don't know. Do you want to really talk about race? And then she went back. Then she went back to meet with her editor. And apparently she didn't realize it, but she was speaking so fast, having drank 5 cups of coffee, that everyone was like, you need to calm down. go read that story, B. Jolie Shaw and the Frisky. She's wonderful. Very funny reporter. Very funny writer.
It's great that she doesn't drink. I'm always looking for other people who don't drink caffeine. Because I converted last year, and I'm a total proselytizer about it. I love it.
Shut up.
So you're a proselytizer about caffeine, but are you a proselytizer about race relations? Does coffee make you want to?
I feel like if everybody drank less caffeine, they probably wouldn't get so worked up over, you know. I feel like white people wouldn't be as sensitive about, you know, the whole slavery thing. You know, you watch like when I watched the 5 and stuff. I think the 5 was talking about this issue on Fox, which is an amazing program because it just is like straight to the heart of the conservative white guy id.
That show totally lives up to its name. There are 5 people, their conversations are 5 out of 10.
Yeah, I don't know.
I feel really 5-y after I watch it. I'm like 5.
But they're off. They're really touchy on race stuff. They're always really touchy, and it's always like a bunch of white people being like, no, you cannot ever say that white people ever did anything.
And that's because they had too much coffee. Is that your point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
I don't think that's why.
So, what are their businesses better suited than Starbucks to maybe like have a conversation about race?
Maybe a like large media company could facilitate this conversation.
It's interesting how hard it is to talk about race, though. Like even with friends and family who you're close with, it is a very, very difficult topic to broach. And you can't just like sort of start a conversation and start talking about race. A conversation does get to the topic of race, that's when it becomes awkward. Nobody says, "Hey, so you know, Dave, you're my black friend. what's it like you being black? I mean, it seems a lot different than it is for me being white." And we would never say that. You'd never say that to Dave. It would make Dave feel uncomfortable. It would make you feel uncomfortable. Everybody would feel bad about that.
Right.
And yet, the reason it makes people feel bad is because there are differences. There are socially constructed differences that make life different for people of color than for people who are not of color. It's like, you know, there are other areas of society where there are differences between people, but I feel like it's just not quite as difficult to talk about there being, there being discrimination or whatever you.
Are you sure you don't drink coffee? I feel like you are perfectly living up to the race with us challenge. You're doing a good job.
Yeah,
race together.
So I'm not sure I follow.
I just feel like you're doing a nice job.
And so you're conceding my point that drinking coffee. Oh no, you're rejecting my point. I'm trying to figure out where it is.
I don't know what I'm doing.
To be honest with you, as a total waspy white guy, like I feel like what I need to do is not so much participate in a conversation as I need to like sit back and listen to other people, seek out other voices, you know, try to use Twitter to like find more diverse viewpoints in my own.
Have more black friends.
Yeah, and instead of like constantly trying to interject what I think about shit into a conversation, instead absorb, learn a little bit. Thanks to Twitter, I read 2 really great books last year by Keith Lehman, and taught me a lot about, you know, the black moms and black sons, and what that's like. It's a completely different world, completely different way of organizing your life. And, you know, it brought me close to the whole notion of what privilege really means. Fantastic books. I feel like Roxane Gay last year put out 2 really good books that explore the same theme. So, you know, just like,
but, I mean, reading
take
helps.
The opportunity to like expand your network a little bit and do a lot more listening. you know, you can learn a lot.
I think reading helps, but I think people don't get, like, people don't get persuaded about big things like race or gender by listening to, like, philosophical debates and arguments. I think they change their minds and they become less hostile by just having to be immersed with people who are different.
That's true.
And so I think that's one reason why diversity is really, really important. It's not just, you know, when we look at things like affirmative action, we tend to look at it from a very individualistic perspective, and we don't look at it from the perspective of, hey, you know, when we actually immerse ourselves together, the differences actually start to break down. We start being part of the same community, and we don't look at each other as being other and different and weird. We look at each other as being Frank and Steve and, you know, Jenny or whoever. I think that's how things have changed throughout history too. I mean, I think you see societies change not because you have a lot of big thought leaders going around telling people here's how you ought to think, but people just have to live together. And unfortunately, with the way race works in American society, we still have a very segregated society. Even, you know, like when I went to UVA, there were tons of black students at UVA, but the student body was very, very segregated.
Yeah, it was when I was there too.
It was very segregated, and yeah. It wasn't because we didn't have enough black students. I think as a percentage of the population, UVA was pretty good. But people didn't mix it up. We've got to find a way to get people to mix it up if we're going to make race better. I don't think you get there just by debates.
Yeah, probably so. Well, there's our awkward conversation about race, you know, but you know, I think probably, maybe Starbucks is onto something, because I think, like, probably what it takes is like a million and one fumbling, failed attempts to sort of like connect.
I'm on yeah. Howard Schultz's team.
Three
here on this
super
one.
White people.
I totally am siding with him.
Trying that here.
Yeah, like he's sure this is like a goofy attempt and it's sort of botched, but he's trying to do something. And now look, everybody's talking about race. So, like, I mean, to some extent, it's kind of a success.
You win,
wow.
Howard.
All right. That, okay. Zach's going to back Howard Schultz on this. Now I feel bad, but not that bad. All right. Thanks, guys.
Good work.
Yay.
Yay. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Brad Shannon with Ibrahim Balki, Christine Canetta, and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by HuffPost senior politics reporters Zach Carter and Arthur Delaney. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Please check us out in the iTunes store for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something else you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening. We miss you already. All righty. Well, I'll take my coffee cup.